Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I wanted to take some time and reconnect with a longtime friend, somebody who's iconic in his own right. Many of you know his voice and many of you know his name. His name is Mopreme Shakur. Mopreme was introduced to many of us nationally when he was featured on the landmark song by the group Tony Feels Good. He was the rapper that did his thing. And Mopreme was well known as a rapper, as somebody who could get down. Mopreme was also my neighbor. I would see him every day with a high top fade, here in the city of Oakland, even though both of us are from New York. And so we go way back. And a few years after meeting Mopreme, I met another guy, short guy, quiet when I met him. He showed up at my house with a gentleman by the name of Shock G, and his name was Tupac. And I did not know at the time that Tupac was Mopreme's little brother. And then over the years, we got to meet Afeni Shakur, and then I got to know Mopreme. And who his father was, Mutulu Shakur. So he is somebody that we know, we love, and he's been doing his thing for a very long time. And he put out a book. It is called The Thug's Life. And Mopreme, welcome to the show. This has been a long time in the making. And I'm glad that you did the book, for a couple of reasons. There's been a number of books and documentaries, some I've been in. Some you've been in, you've been written about and talked about a lot. And I'm sure many of the things have illuminated some important information, but it's nothing like really hearing it from the perspective of yourself, hearing what your interaction was like with your dad, Mutulu Shakur, hearing what your interaction was like with Afeni or Faye, as you called the Mama Faye. Or your brother Tupac and your sister Set. So welcome to the show, and I'm glad you put this out. How are you feeling right now, and what was it like just writing a book and really telling your life story and giving us an inside perspective of all this, what you've been through, and giving us a bird's eye view with your family?
Well, first of all, thank you for having your boy on Hard Knock Radio. Shout out to all your listeners. Man, it's been a long, long road. I've been writing music most of my life, but this is my first foray into book publishing. And like we were just saying, I'm, when we was coming up, it's keep it real. Real, keep real generation. I did reality rap. So I try to stick to the script. And I know I would get a lot of questions, a lot of eyes, a lot of variations of stories, like you were just talking about. So I really needed to tell my story. People have been trying to tell our story and their ways. And for the record, I had to get mine out there for the record.
I appreciate that. Before we get into the essence of the book, and I think you lay a lot of it out, is there any nagging misperception that people have had of your brother that you feel like got addressed in the book? And has there been any nagging misperception of the Shakur family, in particular, your father, Mutulu, that you were able to kind of address in the book?
One of my pet peeves is that a lot of our people, black and brown people, lack a knowledge of history, of our own history. And I hadn't even thought about it, but I did a book signing with Dr. Kelly, Dr. Robin Kelly, and he said, "Man, your father is one of the top five most important civil rights leaders of the day." I had never thought about it, but it's things like that that people need to know, you know? That's one of them.
What about with your brother?
A lot of people didn't understand my brother's moves, and to a lot, they seem erratic. But there was thought into a lot of these moves. It just didn't always turn out the way he wanted them to. You know what I mean? People didn't know the behind the scenes or the other factors involved in his decisions.
You know, one of the things that really stood out in reading the book is it's easy to overlook and understand how political-minded you are, Mokrim Shakur. And I think a lot of it is that we like to put people in a box, right? So it's like, you know, with Digital Underground, for example, there's a lot of people in digital, right? There was Shock, there was Sleuth, there was Klee, you know,
My
there was a
man.
lot, there was a lot of people, and we like to put them in a box. So, okay, Tupac's the political one. And then we somehow overlook the fact that, say, Money B was just as political, and his father was a Panther too, right? So we see your brother and we forget, like, wait a second. You know, there's a lot of depth to it. So let's talk about the book in you know, what you laid out. Your father, let's start with Mutulu, and your mom, both in their own ways, gave you political education. It seemed like you had no choice but to be political, and you were exposed to a lot of black liberation movements, black revolutionary movements. And when I'm looking at the life of your father, I didn't realize he was involved in these spaces at age like 13 and 14. So let's talk about just the politics that that you all were around early on.
My father had an FBI file at 16. And I think that's a sign of those times. Fred Hampton was out there young as well, you know, politically active, socially conscious, trying to make moves to better the people's condition. And it's just a testament to the times, I think, you know. Plus, my grandmother went blind at age 25. So my father spent a lot of time trying to get her help because of their situation, you know what I mean? And that led him to see all the other issues, you know, with our people, one of them being healthcare, you know, and they were addressing them in different ways. And these different groups are different tools to get things done, you know?
In the book, you talk about having a keen insisting that you understand blackness and what it meant to be black, what it meant to be Afrocentric, what it meant to have a diasporic viewpoint, right? This was emphasized. Did you understand the importance of that? And let me couch this in the fact that you spent a lot of time with your family in North Carolina. And then obviously a lot of time with your family in New York City, Queens to be exact, you know.
Oh.
So talk a little bit about this, you know, your understanding of blackness. And we're talking about in the 1970s. So you look young, but you ain't that young.
Gotta keep my youthful appeal, man.
There you go. Talk a little bit about that, Bopreme. You know, this understanding of blackness and what that really meant, and you know what was instilled in you.
My heart was still is strongly connected to both experiences, both environments. Down south with my mom's family in the country, the first years of my life I spent down there. So I do like that clean, unbothered environment to just grow with no pressure. Usually in the South, there's a lot less pressure than the city. Church. I like things about both worlds, right? And then I got to spend time with my father and that side of the family. They were about liberation theology. They were, it was different, but I loved it because I felt special. When I put my dashiki on, I felt special. Ain't nobody else have a dashiki. Mine's mad loud, you know what I
And we're
mean?
talking about age 5, 6, 7 years old, you're exposed to all this.
Those early years were in the South, and then, later on, I was back and forth. But what I didn't like about the, my black side, my not black, my revolutionary side of the family. There's a lot of Muslims. You didn't eat pork, and I'm like, nigga, I love me some pork. You tripping? Now we have a problem. So it's balancing the two worlds, and I love them both. So I can exercise tolerance for each and still be there.
Did you understand some of the things Matulu was doing at such a young age? What I was fascinated in reading the chapter of him, the Panthers, and the Young Lords. Doing what is now a historic takeover of Lincoln Hospital. And you described that in such detail. I don't know how you have a recollection because it was such a, I mean, it was such, you're a kid, but, reading that is fascinating. And then I didn't know that Matulu, who then moved into practicing acupuncture to deal with, drug addiction that people were experiencing. I did not know that practice was illegal. That chapter in itself is just fascinating. So walk us through some of the highlights, things that you really want to pay attention to, and just the coming together of all these revolutionary groups and taking over Lincoln Hospital and what eventually became the result of that.
Well, that hospital, Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, was known as the butcher shop. The conditions were so poor, the treatment to the people was so poor, it was terrible. A sister named Cleo Silvers hired Mtulu to be he was director of health, a medical director. And
Was this before or after the takeover?
okay, the Puerto Rican group had already taken it over.
The Young Lords.
The Young Lords and some of the Panthers had taken it over already. And once they got control, they set up the detox program and brought Matulu on, our father. And I remember those days. I could tell he was proud. He was glad he had a good job. He was director of, you know what I mean, at the hospital. And then he pursued acupuncture that he was introduced to by a sister named Nobuko Miyamoto. She took him down to Chinatown. He saw what they were doing, but it was against the law. So he found a way to learn how to do it first. He went up to Canada, studied up in Canada, because in Canada they use acupuncture on the lumberjacks. Lumberjacks do all the cutting and sawing, their hands get all cramped up. So the French up there had already started using it. Matulu and a group from Lincoln Detox went to Canada to learn acupuncture. Then they went to China to study more acupuncture. Then they brought it back, started helping the patients. They were doing 200, 300 patients a day, right?
Can we give some context as to what was going on, that there were so many patients? I mean, you all lay that out in the book. What I remember, I'll just put on my New York Bronx hat for a minute, is that in the 70s, a lot of people were coming back from Vietnam. I was too young to really understand what that really meant. I knew there was a war. I knew there was Vietnam, but we were told to stay away because there were junkies and there was a lot of people getting hooked on heroin, right? In the book, you described how your father wanted to, with saying that the way that this government was treating those addictions was to replace it with another addiction, and he
Correct.
wanted to intervene and come up with a new plan, which was to do this acupuncture thing, which was illegal. But you also emphasized that he had compassion, and that was something that was lacking in the regular treatment. So go ahead with that.
Yeah, the government was treating the patients with methadone, which, they called liquid handcuffs, because you had to come back there to get your fix. And like you said, with Vietnam, my connection to it was my mother's brother was a heroin addict, but he's my favorite uncle, my Uncle Joey. So
Uncle Joey.
I would see the effects on him. He didn't go to Vietnam, but he was addicted. And Mutulu would then go to he would then come to California to get licensed, because this was the only place you could get licensed at. And once he was licensed, he started having other problems. Chuck Schumer was a assemblyman back then. The methadone was being backed by the Rockefellers, so they wanted that gravy train to keep coming. Mutulu was a problem,
I did not realize until I read the book. Chuck Schumer, who's a problem today. Thine is
Correct.
Chuck Schumer. You
Correct.
know, Chuck Schumer, who stands in the way of so many progressive things and liberatory things that we want to do. We're going back into the 70s. Here's a guy that was looking at your dad in the 1970s, trying to heal people and doing something that would eventually become institutionalized. I think that's important because you outline that in the book as well, that the things that he was doing is now part of the standard way of treating, addictions. But at the time, Chuck Schumer was a hater before we started using that word.
Correct. Correct. That whole Lincoln Detox incident, my father, Cleo Silver's, the Young Lords, they are responsible for us having patients' rights today, to this very day. That's one of those another pet peeve thing that you mentioned earlier that I, need people to know about. In fact, me and my wife Talia did a documentary on it called "Dope is Death," and we try to depict it in that documentary.
We're talking with Mopreme Shakur, if you're just tuning in. Mopreme has written a book about his life, but chronicling his life from the son of, one of the Shakurs, the prominent ones, the Mutulu Shakur, his brother Tupac. And we haven't even talked about hip hop yet. We're still just looking at this book is incredible in how you're laying out so much information from a bird's eye view. And so I got a million questions, but I want you to kind of a couple of things. Your family, you say in the book that your family is extended, massive extended family. You don't have step, ain't no half siblings. If you're your brother, you're your brother. You also talk about family as being, didn't have to necessarily be blood. So how did you come to understand that? Because there were so many people who are part of your family. It's hard to keep up with all the names, but I thought that was pretty poignant. We said, we didn't half step in family and we didn't half step in politics and freedom.
Absolutely, positively. It was interesting because I met Pac when I was six and he was two. And so, it was my father, me, Afeni, and Pop living together in Harlem. And my Matum just said, "That's your brother." You know, that okay, that's my brother. I don't know. Okay, he didn't say half brother. That's your brother, you know. So I'm like, because until then I had no brother, I had no siblings until then, as far as I knew.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm my mother's only son. So I was like, oh, you know, I'm figuring out life. You know, I was like, cool, I got a brother. I got a brother. And then later on, Seth was born. I got a sister. You know what I mean? And we embrace each other like that.
Right. So there was no half stepping in that. What was Pac like when he was little? I remember you said he couldn't even pronounce your name. They called you Little Matulu, and he had a name for you, and you had a name for him.
He called me Doodle, Doodle. He always had that voice. Even as a kid, he had that scraggly voice. Doodle. And I would call him Pocky. Pocky was, you know. But yeah, I miss that guy. He was a feisty little dude. He was feisty. He was feisty. He was fun and feisty, you know. He was often running with the older group, with the older kids, me and my cousin Kenny Black. And so at it, he was learning a lot from everybody that was older than him. You know, it was a bunch of guys, a bunch of cousins, the Lassanes, it was us and, you know, extended family. So, you know, of course Pac would be with the guys. And yeah, he was a tough little dude.
You know, what was Matula like as a father? What do you remember most that stood out to you? We know him as an iconic freedom fighter, but what do you remember about him as, you know, just pops?
I see it now with different parents and fathers, and it makes me smile because when my father was able to spend time with me, we was rolling. He would call me his little soldier. This is my little soldier. This my little soldier hit me in the chest, and we rolled. You know, my pops was a good driver, so I used to like seeing him drive fight the stick in New York, have his racing gloves. I'm like,
Right.
my dad, cool, Jack. And he was just cool, you know what I mean? When you admire your parents, those fortunate people that actually admire their parents, yeah, he was the coolest.
He was very present, and that stood out to me in reading the book. Like he was taking you and Pac to school, making you all hold hands, like this is your brother. And so, at a time when the stereotype and what we later would find out, what governments would force you to do, you know, which is like you couldn't get government aid if you had a man in the house. And I often tell the story, like our father had to be quote unquote our uncle, you know what I'm saying? In
Was
order
that Claudine,
to.
like in Claudine?
The movie Claudine. But your father, you know, was like, we're going to school, walking y'all to school, being there, teaching you and the whole nine. So he was very, very present, day in and day out. And I don't know, you know, I remember in the book you were saying you had a deep appreciation because even then you could see that what you were dealing with was unusual compared to everybody else.
Because of the activities that they were involved in, Matu and Fanny, there was a lot of meetings. You know, there was a lot of meetings for their groups, for other groups. I mean, my mother had her union meeting, but that's about it. But
Right.
these other meetings were different. There was a lot of yelling, there was a lot of passion. I mean, you know, trying to figure out what the hell's going on, you know.
Did you know the extent of the freedom fighting that they were doing? You lay that out in the book too. Black Liberation Army, you know, expropriations, you know, to pay for that, your father being involved in, you know, liberation movements all around the world. You know, what did the gravity of what he was doing weigh on you? Did you understand?
Not then, not then. And then also, the older we got, it became more dangerous for us to spend time with him. Eventually, he would end up on FBI's 10 Most Wanted, and then we didn't see him at all.
Right.
But a lot of that stuff that was going on was very stealthy.
Yeah.
When I saw the rifles, the duffel bag of rifles, I was still kind of young. I thought, shoot, I hope one of
There
them go back to
was
target practice.
a couple of things that stand out, Mopreme. One, being in the South, you talked about like early on, people in the South learn how to shoot early on, you know. I mean, you know, my half the family's from the South, and my little one has already shot the rifle, right? At a young age. So that wasn't unusual. But I remember in the book you were saying that, you know, Mutulu was in a heated discussion with someone, and you went to see what was going on and saw, you know, 10 rifles sitting on the side of the room, and then you realize, like, oh wow, this is this, you know, they're involved with something very, very serious.
Yeah, the energy around it was real high, and it didn't seem like it was nothing for kids. But it was a rifle. Where they gonna shoot it at? When I'm gonna get mine? I was a kid, but like you said, weapons wasn't completely off limits.
Right.
I'm thinking at some point I might get to shoot that. I ain't never shot a rifle like that. But then, as you get older, you see more clues. Like in the, when I was in the post office, seeing his wanted poster in the post office, seeing these weird activity around my house with these strange white folks, and start putting
Yeah,
it together.
you give a lot of detail about COINTELPRO, surveillance, all this that, you know, at the time you probably didn't really fully appreciate, but reading the book is just fascinating. Afeni, you know, when you Afeni comes into your life, she's already iconic in her own sense because, as you talk about in the book, she defends herself as the Panther 21. But what was the dance like with her? What was the relationship like with her?
I mean, it was good because I didn't have to explain to her who I was. We went through a period of like 8, 9 years where the whole family was non-communicado. But when my father was captured in like 86, everyone started coming out the woodwork.
Right.
And I had just gotten out the army, and I decided I could have went to LA or the Bay. I chose to go to the Bay Area, and just so happened that Afeni Pa cassette were there.
Right.
And Matula was connecting everybody. He's sitting down now. He in Lompoc. He's sitting down. So he on the phone every day. Call this one. I call your cousin. Call your and someone gave Fanny my contacts, and she sent me a card and invited me to Thanksgiving. That was the first time we, reconnected again. That was like 89.
Right. But you all had a good relationship prior to that, as outlined in the book. You know, Mopreme, the other big thing that's going on at this time is a little genre of music that's emerging called hip hop. And in the backdrop of all this, you know, the beginnings of hip hop is starting to emerge. And you're catching the bug, you're being exposed to it. And you're participating not only in New York, but also in North Carolina, you know, which now we're starting to see, you know, Sha Rock is from there and Disco King Mario is there. And you start to do this dance, and this dance that eventually leads you know, before your famous brother and others, you know, into stardom. So talk about the relationship with hip hop, what that meant for you, and even the fact that you lived in the Red Fern houses in Rockaway, you know, and the first time many people heard of that outside of New York was when the group Third Base talks about it. The Red Fern houses in Rockaway, where no MC would ever go, was where I did my very first show. But you were living there before Third Base. So what? Talk a little bit about your foray into this thing we call hip hop.
I mean, dude, when I once I got to the once I got from as the shorty from North Carolina to New York, I was primarily in urban communities. You know what I'm saying? You could go into the projects or whatever, but I was in Red Fern Projects. I was in Harlem. I was in Rochdale Projects. You know what I mean? My grandmama lived over by Baisley Park. You know,
This is all Queens.
Suffolk Boulevard, 150th Street, and all that. Yeah, man. So I was around it. All that to be said, I was around it all the time, and I had a love for music already. So my family, my Aunt Joanna played the organ, and growing up in the church, I was in like four choirs. You know, I was in like three, four choirs.
Wait a
So.
second, I didn't know you sung.
I don't. I try.
Man, you kept that on the tuck, man. You never sing.
No,
Did you try to sing when you were at the Tonys?
no, 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 no.
Was Raphael and them like, nah, you sit this one out, son. We got this.
I left that to the professionals. You know, but they end up giving me a shot, so I love them ones.
Right. But you were with these four choirs, but I was pleasantly surprised to see that Matulu was with the hip hop early on, because when it was starting to come out, as opposed to many adults in New York at that time, they were turning their nose up at it, and he was like, man, listen to this. And King Tem the Third and all that early stuff you was into, and it was kind of encouraged.
Yeah,
Nobody was shooting it
last
down.
poets, you know, the Watts Prophets, last poets, and my Baba Bilal, Sunni Ali, was in the Midnight Band with Gil Scott-Heron.
I didn't know that.
So the music, the revolution will not be televised, is literally my people involved with that too. The song Baba Lab played sax and flutes and wind
Right.
instruments. But the birth of hip hop was just like our version of the rap. You know, the rap. You know, we bumped it up a notch or two. You know, sheer ingenuity, grit, talent. We took the throwaways, they threw away disco, we took disco, we took some soul, you know, add a couple of drum kicks and bass to it, get our poetry on. It was good. I just love it. It's a way to sink yourself into some creativity and you get lost for a few minutes.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Mo Preem Shakur, and your book is divided. The book is called The Thug's Life. It's
This thug's life.
divided. It's thug's this thug's life. This thug's life. I'm sorry. This thug's life. You can go knee deep into the political stuff, which I was talking to you about. We can do a whole hour on that, but I want to fast forward. So I see you here in the Bay. You get out the army. You're living next door. This is my neighbor. I'm seeing you every day. High top fade.
Chilling.
I have no idea that my neighbor is throwing, lyrics. Could get busy. How did this happen? How did you catch up with the Tonys? What led to that iconic song "Feels Good" with you flowing on it? And how did you manage to keep this on the tuck?
You know what it is? Nobody knew me. Nobody knew me.
Okay.
I got out the military and I got out with some money. I invested in myself. I put myself in a studio. I hooked up with my man Kenya Groove, Eric Baker, my man Kenya, who's the brother of Elijah Baker, who was in Tony. So when I went to drop my demo, I was doing songs for my demo up at Joe Capers. Kenya's brother and came in with the rest of the Tonys. I was like, oh shit. And I'm in the booth working on my music. So they heard me. I was happy that they came by. I got to meet the fellas. I was like, oh wow, this is dope. And then later on, Kenya hit me up. He said, yo, Ray wants to know if you wanna get on a song. I was like, what? Hell yeah. Because my goal was to get in the game. Get in the game. I'm not that selfish to think I want everything to be on to be mine. So I'm a collaborator. So I dug the collaboration. And I jumped on it. I jumped on the opportunity, went up there to see Ray when he was up on 94th back then. He was in East Oakland. And he played it for me. As soon as I heard the track, I knew it was
And
big.
for people, when he says Ray, he's talking about Raphael Saadiq.
Yeah, excuse me, Brother Raphael Saadiq, my man. And it was like, yeah, we was gonna have Hammer do it, but he too, Hammer was hot right then. So I just,
Wait, so Hammer was gonna do was initially gonna do the rhyme on that? They tried to get him,
they
but
wanted
he
Hammer.
was blowing up at the time.
Yeah, Hammer was hot as fish grease. And he's way more expensive than me. But they gave me a shot. And man, the rest is history. Recorded at the plant over there in Sausalito. And again, I got this opportunity. I'm getting on, but nobody knows me because I'm a new implant from, New York, by the way, the Army, but
Did you even say your name in that rap? I'm trying to remember.
Mercedes DeMille,
That's what,
quite a nice fellow. Met
yeah.
3T, hit a rhyme a cappella.
Yeah, but Mo Prime is what we know you as, so Mercedes.
Yeah, I'm an artist. We evolve. You dig?
I hear you. So what happens after that?
A lot.
What how's your path kind of emerge? Because at this time, there's another group, Digital Underground. They're transplanting out here, some of them. Shock is moving here, Fuse is moving here, Money B is here, Chopmaster J out of Berkeley. So they're forming, a thing. Did you all connect at this time? And then, eventually your brother joins Digital Underground. So as you're blowing up, what's the path that Mercedes, Mo Prime, what was the dance like for you at that point after, Feels Good comes about?
Well, my little brother was inspired and felt like if my brother's gonna be on a record, because that's all these artists go, they want to get on something that's gonna be heard on the radio, heard in the masses. And he felt like if I did it, he felt like he definitely could do it. Little did I know, he was ready. Because that time that we had spent apart when our families were on the ground, he was training. He had already did the Apollo, Raising in the Sun at 13. He had already been to Baltimore School of the Arts. He had already been hanging out at Latin Quarters in New York as a shorty.
And he took on the name MC New York.
MC New York, in fact. Yes, sir. So, he had been rapping with Ray Love and DJ Diz, Strictly Dope. Shout out to them, my guys. And once he hooked up with Atrium got him.
H and Gregory.
Yes, sir. Atrium Gregory got him with Digital. Once he got with Digital, I went with him to watch his back and, offer my support, guidance, whatever I could do, because that's my little brother. We fell into that mold. I'm trying to look out for my little brother. So Mercedes got put on hold, while we were dealing with him. And the rich, talented family of Digital Underground, in which I have been made a member, long time ago. I didn't even know it. I just confirmed with Money B. Get out of here. But yeah, so We had the utmost respect for Shock. Shock, who was also trained musician, out of Tampa, Florida. Now we all together around this time. Look how rich that community is. Don't forget Big D the Impossible, my man,
Right.
part of Digital. But we had all that talent bubbling right there, and then Shock has Humpty Dance. Whoop.
Yeah.
We out of here, baby. Feels Good was on the radio. I mean, we were just blessed with opportunities and few hits.
When I talked to your brother, he said he had a vision. This is just before he did the movie Juice. And he said, I want to have these other groups, and those groups eventually became ones that you're a part of. The Outlaws, is one that comes to mind. The Have Nots, which was a younger group. There was a third one that you Thug Life,
Oh,
right?
no.
Yeah, Thug Life. Yeah, that one. First of all, let's talk about Thug Life. I remember you telling me that you sat down with Matulu and you all really wrote out a long-term plan about what this would be and what it would be like, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe you can share with us, because I don't want people to think that you all just sat around and just did things for the sake of doing it. There's a lot of planning going on, and you all had long-term visions for all these groups that were spinning off.
Correct. Because remember, we come from a family of community organizers. Pop was still a
Right.
community organizer. Pop was like, if the rap shit didn't work, he was going to start the New African Black Panthers. So that was still on the brain. Thug Life went from 50
He's showing
niggas,
me his tattoo,
50 niggas.
right.
Eventually involved into Thug Life. We lost one of the homies, Big Kato, and that affected Pac deeply. And he wanted to find a way to reach everybody, not just sectioned out, just the New Yorkers or just the Southern, just Crips, but just something that an umbrella that he could address all the people, our people who we consider our people, the disenfranchised, poor black, brown people, people suffering from poverty, and we, the way it sounds straight off, it's not warm and fuzzy. People don't necessarily like the name Thug, anything, Thug, anything,
Right.
right? But we felt and we knew that they would say Thug on their lips, but nigga would be on their tongue.
Right.
We know what you mean. We embracing that shit. You ain't nothing. Yeah, we try to make it so they can't make anything to suppress us any longer. Whatever they try to use to suppress us, we flipping it, we flipping it, flipping it. The hate you gave little infants fucks everyone.
Right.
Because if you don't watch out for those babies, they grow up to be the monsters you fear today. And we talked to Matulu about it. Me and Pop was living together. He was locked up in Lompoc, and we would talk, have these powwows, and Pop would express his side of it, and my father would express his side of it.
So
And like
what was Matulu's take on it at that time?
he was like, Thug Life, it's all this thug. What you gonna do? Knock somebody in the head, put a gun on them, take their pocketbook. What is this? It gotta mean something. You can't just be out there just reckless with it. And then Pac would respond in kind. He was like, "Look, Matula, we out here working. Me and Mo out here working. We trying to get this money. We trying to get the message to the people. We ain't got time to be sitting down writing all the." He said, "You write it. You write the Thug Code." And then my pops proceeded to write his version of the Thug Code. A list of outlines and bylaws for us to try to abide by so we can survive. Our
Did
people.
you all add your own input to this? Because if I remember when I talked to you a long time ago, you said that you all kind of collaborated. It wasn't just him.
He would do, he started out and get some plays, and then we would interject what he needs here, what he needs there. He would go back next time we talk. And then it was kind of hard because we'd be on the road and, a bunch of guys, a bunch of people around trying to hear him. But yeah, I had firm confidence in his, what he was going to do with the Thug Code and,
What did the what were a couple of points in the Thug Code that we should kind of sink our teeth into? I'll let them read the book to get it all, but what were a couple of points that were important to you?
Yeah, I didn't include it in the book, but there is, some of it is, no-brainers, like no slanging by schools, no shooting by schools. If there's a problem with two groups, there's a problem between the two groups, the representatives should try at least twice. Don't just try once, try twice. To resolve the issue. Just, no brainer sh shit. I haven't actually, truthfully, I haven't looked at it in a long time because I live it every day. But yeah, it was some good information.
You know, the Outlaw Immortals, what was that about?
Outlaw Immortals was about passing the torch. The younger groups that came up under us. You mentioned the have-nots. You mentioned there's the Young Thugs, there's Dramacital. They went through their artistic journeys, right? Because we had our cousins, we had Man Man's little brother. We had local people from the Bay Area, local kids. Pac was always trying to look out for the kids, and the outlaw, the Young Thug, Dramacital was getting older. Pac was now at death row. Oh shit, I just thought I felt an earthquake. Pac was now at death row, and it was a way of people knew Thug Life, but they didn't know the Outlaws. They didn't know the Outlaws yet. So this was the introduction to the world of the Outlaws on Pac's album, first album Out of Jail. So it was a big deal. So we wanted
Right.
to have a maximum pop, and the perfect name was Outlaw Immortals,
And
Thug Life Outlaw.
everybody had a name that reflected some sort of embattled leader, right? So what, everybody from Mussolini to Gaddafi to, you name it. Who else did you have? You have
I was Khomeini.
Khomeini, that's right.
It's Hussein Fatal. Napoleon. yeah, that was Yavin, Castro.
What was the point behind that? Why did you all pick those names? Why did you go in that direction?
Pac picked those names specifically because Pac was irritated about all these dudes from, at the time, there was a lot of dudes using, gangster monikers, especially out of New York, and Pac was going to decide to one up him because he thought on a global scale anyway. So it really makes sense to, the way he thought, but we shut all that
So
shit
while
down.
they were going, let me call myself Gotti and,
Yes.
Scarface and all that, he was like,
Yes.
well, if you're gonna go there,
Yes.
let me get some international figures and we'll take
Correct.
on those monikers.
Correct. Correct.
Two things. I didn't realize that there was a plan to add a woman in, and was it in Thug Life and it just didn't work out, or was it the Outlaws? I forget which one
It was
Storm was
Thug
in.
Life.
It was
Well,
in Thug Life, yeah.
Thug Life, shout out to Yanni. Yanni from Richmond, California, a homegirl. Pac loved Yan very much, and he wanted her to be down, but
Right.
she's so real. Like, I want to do that shit. I thought about it. I'm good. She was like, good. She sold her fame. None of that shit really impressed her. But she was a cold rapper at the time, so she fell out. We let her go her way. And then later on, Storm, shout out to Storm. She was part of the Outlaw Clique, the only female down with the Outlaw Clique. Cool, good sister.
We're talking with Mopreme, the Mopreme Shakur. As I'm reading the book, I'm just thinking to myself, so many, how cathartic was this for you? Because so many people are no longer with us that you write about. I don't know how how you process that. How important was it to write some of this, being in the moment, because there's so many things that are real. Let me just say this. I mean, the writing is good. It ain't no clinical thing. I feel like I'm right there on the page with you. And like when you touch down, it's like
Credit to my
I'm like,
co-writer. Credit to my co-writer, Talia. She pulled it out of me.
okay. So, what was the most compelling chapter for you? To really write that you was like this, I want people to really read.
From chapter 23 on. 23 to 25, baby. Yeah,
Right.
that was a culmination, a long ride, a lot of history, a
Yeah.
lot of pain.
You're talking about, I'm not going to use the expletive, but one is called Stop, Sugar 2, S, and Machiavelli's Last Ride. And I think chapter 21, Thunderstorms, also, is coming to light as well. What do you want people to get out of this, other than really getting this story from your vantage point? What do you hope people really walk away with at the end of the day after reading this?
I want them to be inspired to hang in there and believe in yourself. Stay strong. We are strong people. Love each other. To never give up. Keep pushing straight ahead. Straight ahead. I mean, Dave, you know me. You see, this book was important, especially all the people I have lost before I got to put it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long list.
I wish Shaq could have read it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's so many, so
Let
many.
me just give an idea. We lost Shock. We just lost Klee. We lost D the Impossible. Right, obviously your brother, which Afeni. We lost all the members of the Outlaws except you.
No, there's a couple of them still there.
Well, we lost. Who did we lose? We lost
Fatal, Noble,
Fatal.
Gaddafi. Yeah, those are major. We lost Johnny J.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go on. Unfortunately, Stretch was with us. He's
Yeah.
gone. I mean, so many. And I felt it was really important for history's sake. These guys shouldn't be forgotten. We did some historical shit, some memorable shit. It was a especially that time in the Bay Area was a great time in music and entertainment, I feel like. I mean, it was so rich with artists that. And we all was getting down with each other. There wasn't that much beef. My man Shorty B with Too Short, Dangerous Crew, Atomic Social Club, J. King, Foster McElroy. I mean, it was so, I just loved that period that we had so much going on in the Bay. And I wasn't from there like you. I'm from New York, but I'm like, yo, it's cracking up here. I just loved
But
it.
you were part of the clique no matter what.
I was
Yeah.
blessed to be a part of the clip. Yes.
A good part of the book talks about COINTELPRO. And one would be remiss not to look at the target that's on the back of the Shakurs. And one of the chapters you talk about, when your brother's on trial, Afeni looks and sees somebody who was around when she was defending herself, which would have been, like 20 years earlier from the 1972. Here you are, in the 90s, and they're sitting in this court. And I'm just, and then when I look at some of the people that are in the crew, that pass, especially in the more political side, do you ever wonder, what's the government's hand, whether it's direct or indirect, in any of the stuff that, has culminated in either the efforts being redirected or the efforts just being totally stopped at the moment, at a particular moment?
It was definitely talked about. I mean, we were like, yo, they've been watching us since we all through high school. Why they was chasing them around? They know who we are. They know who we are. We can't. We felt like we couldn't live in fear. We couldn't live in fear. We had to just do our thing and stay righteous and do our thing. Whatever they after, it ain't here. So, we tried to stay with the art. We kind of took the family to General Market. You know what I'm saying? But there's a lot that we do know about COINTELPRO. There's a lot that we do know about the history of COINTELPRO and how they operate. Now, they might have changed the name, but a lot of methods were still the same. They have a lot of information. Look, D, my father and my aunt. Well, both on FBI's 10 most wanted list. You think they wasn't looking at us on top of us? Come on, man. So we just, tried to stay righteous as possible, and it was difficult because bullshit got in the game. Bullshit got in the game, and Pac was still 25. He's 25. So did the best we could under the circumstances.
I know a lot of people want to speculate. Are you surprised at the political moment that we're in right now? The removing of voting rights acts, the type of energy that is devoted to totally upending black people, brown folks, indigenous folks. I mean, this is a full-out all attack. I guess a lot of people would, in a point in time, they would be like, "What would Matulu say at this time? What would he be telling people to do? What would Pac say? Is he around? And what does Mopreme think we should be doing at this point in time?"
I have ref been reflecting quite often on now the elders and their situation and what we're going through right now and how they will react and how they're similar and how they are not. I think one of the differences is the liberal side, the Democratic side, our side. Suffered a lot of assassinations. And it's scary because it feels like they're prepping the ground. At some point, you just got to say that what they're doing is racist. What they did in Tennessee, North Carolina, Alabama, Indiana. I'm like, yo, really? Is that how it's going down? But I'm actually kind of proud of people for keeping it cool. We can see it coming. They're not that shrewd with it, So we have to keep control because it feels like, to me, it feels like they want another George Floyd type riot to pop off so they can put the full hammer down and lock us up in these detainment centers they're trying to build all over the country. People pay attention. People pay attention. People pay attention. Nazis, the Gestapo, if they're not them, why are they acting like them?
What do you think your brother would do at this point in time?
Oh, his head will be exploding. His head will be exploding. I don't know how much cool he would have. I don't know how much cool he would have because they're abusing us on every level.
What about Matulu? Because here's somebody who did pick up the gun. Here's somebody who, see, it's one thing to talk about things in the abstract. Man, if I had been a slave, this is what I would do, right? And it's another thing to kind of ride the coattails of folks and go, yeah, this is the land of the Panthers, and there's the, there was Ram and there was New Africa Republic. It's one thing to claim that. It's another thing when you're actually involved with those things and you're going out, putting in work, as they like to say, in a whole other level, where you all did have to go underground, where people did go to jail in due time, and many people were tortured behind those cages, and folks, was really about freeing us for the love of the people. It wasn't done to be on Facebook and get a Pulitzer Prize or anything like that. This was really about liberation. So when I asked that question, and just this being your father, who went through it, and who you talked to before, during, and after, what do you think those type of revolutionaries would say to us at this moment in time?
I think they would be saying, prepare. I think that the level of commitment that they had was way deeper than the level of commitment now. And that's why I'm talking about the stuff I'm trying to talk about. We should prepare. We should prepare because it don't look good. He's cats in the White House is not holding back. But we've been here before.
Do you think we have that level of commitment? Because let me tell you what I think, Moprim. I just want comfort. I've said this before. All I want is just to be able to turn on my TV, PlayStation, go to, Chipotle, get my food, and I just want business as
Chill,
usual.
right?
As long as I just want to chill, right? And that's not what your family, the entire Shakur clan, the extended of it, who you break down, all those revolutionaries in their family, they weren't about that. They was like, it's more than just our personal comfort. And I just wonder how we can move from point A to point B. How do I move from, I just want to be able to do my PlayStation, to really preparing for the storm that's about to come? And there's so many ways in which people can prepare, but if I'm kind of hedging my bets on, I just want comfort, man. I just want to be able to sit here and just play dominoes with the homies and not have to trip. How do I move from that mindset to the mindset of folks that literally died in your family, to free us?
It's hard because, like I said, the difference is that there was more commitment, more passion because of the pain of those assassinations. We got Malcolm Martin Meagher and JFK. I think that was real impactful for them, especially Martin Luther King. another story. I don't know if this is in the book, but Summer of Soul concert in New York back in the 70s.
69, if I remember.
69,
Yeah,
yeah.
six, yeah.
My father did security with the Panthers. They was up in the trees at the concert for Nina Simone. It made them it pushed them a little harder. It pushed them harder. I think it's going to take another event for people to really start waking up. Alex Pretty and Renee Good in was it Milwaukee,
Minneapolis, Minneapolis.
Minneapolis? They're lucky. I mean, the powers that be are lucky that didn't kick it off, but I think it might end up being another incident because this administration is so irresponsible. So they're irresponsible and they're pushing the racist narrative, and that ain't gonna play with a certain type of person. So they can play that role if they want to, and they think they can beat up everybody. That's why they're running around the world bombing everybody, and they're stuck in Iran. So we gonna see, but everybody wake up, keep your head on the swivel. You know what I'm saying? It can happen. Like you were just talking about the comfort. I think we America, we're real comfortable. We're very comfortable. That's the problem. And now people are starting to get uncomfortable. You dig? That shit is so unfair in Tennessee. How they're gonna have all the districts, just all of them. Black folks don't get one district. Come on, man. You can't even reason with if you're starting out like that. Anyway.
Mopreme, I appreciate you taking time. I have a million more questions, but
Well,
you
we
gave
hang out,
us,
eat some food, eat some Chipotle,
but you
man.
definitely, do that. But you gave us, 26, 27 chapters to go through, including the epilogue and everything. Each chapter stands out on its own. I didn't even get a chance to ask you. You have a fascinating chapter about Bruce Lee.
Oh, yeah.
When I read that, I had to call Jeff Chang and said, "Man, look at this chapter on Bruce Lee. This
It's
needed to be in your book."
very
The fact
important.
that you all took karate and what he meant and what and that whole nine is jewels in itself. Hearing about hip hop as it's emerging in the backdrop of the revolutionary stuff that the family's going through. And really getting an insight into the relationship with your brother, Pac, and your sister, Set, and seeing, just how y'all was growing up and just seeing the world, I think is fascinating. I appreciate you writing the book, and I hope people get a lot out of it because it's obvious that you put a lot of heart and soul into it. And as you said, your co-writer Talia brought some stuff out of you. So shout out to her for doing that because it ain't easy,
No, sir. No, sir.
But it's a compelling book. So Mopreme, I'll let you get the last word. Anything you want to say?
I want to say God bless you. Thank you for checking it out. Shout out to the Hard Knock family. Check me out. I got a new joint out with Raz Kaz, Bishop Lamont, Mopogo Lions. It's on the new David Chappelle special. We grinding, we grinding, we
Oh,
grinding.
that's right. I forgot you rap still. I forgot.
Oh,
Yay, I forgot you an MC. I keep forgetting. I'm talking to you, and then it's like, oh yeah, it's like I was sizing you up, thinking maybe I can get on the mic and do a little something. Then I remembered, you're still an MC. He's
hey,
still.
man. 30 years in the game, baby.
We're gonna take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right
Peace.
back.